might see. I gave this talk at UC Irvine, but part of the unified frameworks is stuff that you've probably heard from Cynthia about little M theory, so I'll not spend very much time on that. More I want to tell you about some new ideas, a new program that I'm developing with some collaborators that we're calling Whimsically Marmoset, tell you what it is, tell you what the purpose of it is. Let's just backing up, starting a postdoc, I think I'm feeling that, like a lot of model builders, the question of what will model building be like when the LHC turns on, model building in the LHC era. And one thing that's become kind of quickly clear to me is that that we're going to be thinking a lot about tools for data analysis. And the reason is that if you go into HetPH and you ask how many models have model builders come up with, and then ask how many Monte Carlo tools are available to simulate all those models, you see that there's a huge disparity, that people have many more models than there are Monte Carlo tools to simulate them. If you're lucky and your model has a low energy version in terms of the MSSM, okay, then there is Pythia or SmadGraph or so on, tools that allow you to simulate those models. But even if you make small deformations, thinking about the next minimal supersymmetric standard model as the low energy version of your model, then I don't know if there's actually an official version. You can certainly search the web, do a Google search, and there's people who have code to do the NMSSM and Pythia and so on, but there's no vetted code that everyone believes in. If you have models like the littlest pigs, then you have to go and ask your friends. For example, if you ask Patrick Mead, he has the littlest pigs coded up on his hard drive. But kind of any other model, anything else, you're really talking about having to spend 2 months with a program like Compat or MadGraph or something like that in order to implement that model. This problem here, there's kind of two ways of saying it. You know, one way of saying it that this is our section six problem. That is, we write our theory paper. Section one is the introduction. Section two is motivation. You get on to section six, the LHC phenomenology of your model. We don't have efficient ways of figuring out the LHC phenomenology of more generic models. But more likely when the LHC turns on, that this is going to be the problem. That is, we're going to have theoretical Lagrangians, we're going to have LHC data. And what method are we going to use to go between LHC models and LHC data, and also figuring out what the reverse situation is? So this is kind of the motivation for thinking about model building in the LHC era. How are we going to accomplish, or how are we going to deal with this asymmetry? And in terms of thinking about unified frameworks for the LHC, there are two types of unification that you can imagine undertaking. One is a kind of theoretical unification. And this is the theoretical unification where someone says, I have a model, model A. Someone else says, oh, I have another model, model B. And then you realize, oh, wait a second, these models are actually one and the same from one unified Lagrangian to different Lagrangian parameters. And if you have a unified Lagrangian that describes both model A and model B, then you can write just one Monte Carlo tool. So this is the case of the MSSM. The MSSM is a unified Lagrangian that describes the low-energy physics of many, many different SUSY models. So we have cage mediation, anomaly mediation, but their LHC phenomenology can be described entirely in terms of one unified framework, the MSSM. And what I do with Cynthia and Liantao Wang is just accomplish the same structure for composite Higgs theories, that many seemingly different composite Higgs theories are describable in terms of one underlying Lagrangian. So the simple group for little pigs, the minimalist for little pigs, some 5D composite Higgs scenarios all can be described with some little M theory, just like the MSSM can describe anomaly mediation, gauge mediation, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to be talking much about this kind of theoretical unification. This is a good kind of unification in the sense that you're not losing any information. You start with some high energy theory, you run it down to a low scale, you get a Lagrangian net. Measuring those parameters, that's all you can imagine doing at the LHC. The kind of thing I'm going to be talking about today is experimental unification. That is, you have model A, and model B. And these models are fundamentally different. They may have even different spins of their particles. But for whatever reason, at low luminosity, they end up having the same LHC data. And in this case, you wish you had one Monte Carlo tool, because with the luminosity that you have, you can't quite yet distinguish model A from model B. Maybe with more luminosity, with linear collider, you might be able to tell the difference. But with the available LHC data, you wish you only had one Monte Carlo tool to simulate them. And this is the goal of this program, Marmoset. How can you take different models that may have completely different mass scales, completely different spin structure, but the same rough LHC data? How can you Monte Carlo for something? How can you Monte Carlo both possibilities of model A and model B at the same time if you don't know what the actual model is? And so this is the idea that we're going to be talking about today.
Marmoset stand for something?
Yes, it does. I'll tell you what it stands for. So this program, Marmoset, stands for mass and rate measurements. In on-shell effective theories. So this is not an effective theory in the Wilsonian sense. This is an effective theory in terms of what mass scales you're dealing with. So an on-shell effective theory is going to be a specification of masses, cross-sections, and branching ratios, but without matrix elements. And the goal of this program is to give you some mass and rate information about those theories. Hopefully with error bars that would allow you to figure out how likely is it that, given this on-shell effective theory, how likely is it that various masses and rates that you've measured are the real ones. Let me just kind of give you a sense of why we came up with this program, or why we thought this program would be useful. So what keeps me up at night is the following situation. Imagine you have the LHC sees an excess of events with 4 B jets, 4 leptons, and missing energy. This is something that's well above background. If you see an excess in this channel, besides after you pop the cork on the champagne bottle, you'd like to figure out what this model is. And let's say, for whatever reason, we figured out these 4 leptons are really coming from 4 Ws. So we have 4 Bs, 4 Ws, and we're convinced that there's a source of missing energy in addition to various leptons around. Let's assume we've already figured out that. How do you tell the difference between the following scenarios? Imagine a Suffi scenario, PP bar goes to spottom, and the spottom goes to some jet, and the chargino goes to a neutralino, and I'm going to change my model. I'm going to make it gluino pair production. The gluinos go to VV bar. Gluinos go to EV bar.
EV bar chargino?
Yeah, that's not what I wanted. I really want this. Sorry. TV bar chargino. W neutralino. Okay, so this model here with a TV bar W, TV bar W, and missing energy, this is going to contribute to this channel of 4 Bs, 4 Ws, and missing energy. How can you tell the difference between this and an equally likely scenario? And I'll just change one of the sides of the decay. How do you tell the difference between this and this structure, where the gluino goes right to TP bar and the neutralino, there's no additional W from a lower part of the decay channel? How do you tell the difference between these two possibilities? If you really believe it's Suzy, then you can simulate both of these two possibilities. But let's say you're not convinced that it's Suzy. How do you, in a more model-independent way, just assess this very simple question of, are there Ws coming from tops, or are the Ws coming from a lower part of the decay chain? And if we really believe that there's a natural solution to the hierarchy problem, you might expect that this could happen all the time. You might expect top-rich samples, maybe there's other Ws floating around. How do you tell the difference between uncorrelated BWs and BWs that are correlated with the existence of tops? So this is the kind of question that this program is attempting to address. And so this program is being written along with Philip Schuster, Natalia Toro, Jared Kaplan, Vivian Fitzpatrick, with some cheerleading by Steve Morena and Bruce Knudsen. And where by cheerleading I mean we had to convince them that this wasn't a bad idea before anyone else could believe that this was a valid idea. And the goal of this program is to do Monte Carlo without matrix elements. That is, be able to simulate some theory in terms of these blobs, and to be able to compare PP goes to some new particle, don't know what it is, may not even know what its color or charge is, going to the final states, PD, Z, et cetera, et cetera. Simulate some notion of on-shellness of particles, but not actually put any matrix elements into the game to try to assess, do I have tops or not? Can I figure out, without putting in angular correlations that you would get from matrix elements, can I figure out whether or not there are tops in the game? Can I figure out what the real final states are? And this is especially important in high multiplicity environments where you may or may not actually get to all the final states and where you are going to have to rely on having a good detector simulation to tell you what is the probability that you're really going to get both of these Bs, you're going to miss the Bs, what is the B tagging efficiency in an environment where there's all sorts of other junk around, et cetera.
So are you, is your primary thing going to be this final state list of particles, let's say BB, four Bs, four Ws,
expressing
it, and then there's different networks of blobs that could connect?
Right, so the actual way we're thinking about doing it is to say an experiment comes up with an excess, and then you as a theorist or whoever can go in and say, I want to test this hypothesis of these blobs. If I put in these blobs, what is the cross-sections and branching ratios I get out of this story? Unlike the other program that Steve Brennan and Bruce Knudsen are working on, where given final states, construct all Feynman diagrams consistent with those final states and try to assess whether those Feynman diagrams reproduce something. Here, the goal is to say, I'm going to input an idea for what an on-shell effective theory would be. On-shell effective theory meaning the specification of what masses of particles I can put in and how they can decay.
That's a good cross-section. You also mean...
So the magic of this program is that you fit for cross-sections and branching ratios. You don't simulate for cross-sections and branching ratios. Okay, so let me explain that. So the hypothesis that we're working under, this is a hypothesis that we're trying to test right now. And if it's true, then this program is great. If it's not true, then okay, we'll have to go back to the drawing board. But the hypothesis is that the leading LHC phenomenology, and by leading, I mean the kind of information you can expect to get in 10 inverse femtobarns, maybe 100 inverse femtobarns, but I expect that when you're starting to get into the more high luminosity, integrated luminosity regime, you're going to be sensitive, again, to matrix elements. So this is where we think you can probably get away without matrix elements for maybe the first 10 inverse femtobarns. That the leading LHC phenomenology is described by mass scales, cross-sections, and branching ratios. And we have some evidence that you may also be sensitive to which PDFs you use to create things, that it's different if you make a blob with incoming gluons versus making it with incoming valence quarks, let's say. And we expect that you can get accuracy on the level of 5 to 20%. So this is not precision physics, but hopefully at the 5 to 20% level, you could say, what is the chance that I'm making tops as opposed to uncorrelated BWs? And the key thing is no matrix elements. Now, it's extremely easy to teach Pythia how to do this, for example. Pythia, you can set whatever matrix elements you want. So it's very easy to take a program like Pythia and hack it up to basically set every cross section, or every amplitude, squared amplitude, and just making it a constant. And it's also very easy to teach Pythia to decay things by a phase space. So there's no physics in implementing this scheme. But if this is true, so the Pythia side is easy, and with Steve Moran's help, we've been able to hack Pythia to do things only in terms of mass scales, cross section, and branching ratios, and a little bit of PDF information. But the magic is, if this is true, then two facts. The first thing is that it's very easy to make Monte Carlo for any model. You specify which states can go on shell, and then you can just simulate. That is, you can just say, I want to make pairs of stops or pairs of T primes. But you don't actually have to specify stops or T primes. You don't have to get the matrix elements right. You just say, I want pairs of this thing at some given mass. And then the other magic is that cross sections and branching ratios are completely free. That is, you can just reweight various trees to scan over cross section and branching ratios. So without having, you don't have to simulate new Monte Carlo in order to change the branching ratio of, you know, we have some Galeno, you can have a branching ratio to TV bar Chargino or PV bar Neutralino or TT Neutralino. If you simulate enough of this channel, and this channel, you can just rewrite those various things in order to get cross-section branching ratios for free. So the goal is to generate Monte Carlo for every possibility that your on-shell effective theory allows, and then fit for cross-section and branching ratios. And if you fit for cross-sections and branching ratios, you get error bars for free also, because you can assess, you know, you pick some threshold for how good you have to match the data in order to set error bars, so you don't have to re-simulate, you don't have to go into some space, let's say the space of the stop mass and the spot mass. You don't have to simulate each point, figure out whether, in order to figure out what error bars are. Rather, you simulate the two processes of stop production and spot production, and then you just fit what the error ellipse is, which is a very simple calculation. You don't have to do it in the Monte Carlo. So this is the, even if you don't believe my whole story about not needing matrix elements, the fact that if you bin things appropriately, that is, you bin things into exclusive decay trees, that cross-sections and branching ratios are free, is kind of, this is kind of the main point of a tool like Marmoset.
Okay, so you're going to do this based on observed rates.
You're going to fit the cross section and branching ratios to observed rates.
So the experiment has ET thresholds,
yeah,
and geometric acceptance,
yeah,
and so forth that come into play there.
So what we're imagining doing is
and those acceptances can depend on the masses.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what we're imagining doing is you take Monte Carlo and you pass it through your, depending on how much computational time, the best detector simulation that you have, that you, assuming that your detector simulation is an accurate model of what your actual detector is, then you are saying, I'm not simulating the exclusive state TB chi plus, I'm simulating the exclusive TB chi plus, but what I'm getting out from this tree is a whole bunch of different channels. You know, if the lepton from a Chargino decay was under some threshold, then I know that the Monte Carlo is telling me exactly what the whole PT distribution is. And so this shows up in some, it could show up in a BB lepton bin, or it could show up in a BB two lepton bin, or a BB jet bin, or a BB single jet bin, that this tree, and then the observed rates for all these, when I weight this tree, I weight it according to everything that I see. So this is, the other thing I should have said is that this is assuming that the only way that you can figure out what the LHC data is that you have to rely on Monte Carlo, and that you aren't able to measure anything, that the common torque background or whatnot is making it very difficult to make an actual measurement of what you see. You can't measure some edge or endpoint, because in a really lepton-rich environment, you can't figure out how to pair things up. So assuming that you have to use Monte Carlo, you have to trust your detector simulation, what is the best way of taking that detector simulation and matching it on to various theoretical models?
So
But you have to assume a given model and test it. You come up with your best sigma and VR for a given model, then you change your model and
There is going to be cases.
So basically, you implement a given model using the decay tables in Pythia or
that,
something.
That
like
is correct.
That.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. So it doesn't absolve people of the theoretical challenge of figuring out what all the decay modes that you should allow for a given hypothetical situation. You can imagine trying to, you put in some decay modes that you think shouldn't be there and make sure that the program spits back a branching ratio of zero for some decay mode that you think shouldn't be there. For example, a decay mode that violates charge or violates lepton flavor, if you don't see lepton flavor violation in the data, you can put that in and make sure that the program spits back for you a very small branching ratio for an unwanted channel. But yeah, you have to specify the model. You can imagine writing a computer program to take the final states and generate all possible trees based on it, but the goal is more of given final states, you often have some intuition about what you think should be going on. You see an excess of 4Bs and you say, oh, I already know what hypotheses I want to test. I want to test for the relative branching ratios of these three things.
Yeah.
And then this program in principle should be able to take Monte Carlo, assume that your detector simulation is perfect, and you can include all the best knowledge of standard model background, et cetera, and then get to these numbers. So given masses, given states, fit to these two numbers.
Well, The other approach would be to say, okay, well, I think one of these three things, so allow all three models to be present at once, or would you do it one by one?
Yeah, so this is the challenge. You know, so let's take precisely the... imagine trying to do this with Susie. Imagine saying, look, I've already spent all this time developing the Monte Carlo tool for the MSSM. And I am certain that there's a Galeno here, there is a neutralino here, and another neutralino here, and I am convinced that the decay of the Galeno to the neutralino can happen either by a VD or a top-top or a non-VJet. And I'm convinced that this one either goes through a lepton-lepton or a neutrino-neutrino. This program, you simulate, okay, how many things we have to do? We have to simulate 1, 2, 3 possibilities, 3 times the other 2 decay modes, and then on each side. So, okay, a lot of combinatorics there. But in terms of scanning in Susie's space, you can scan the mass of the spotter, you can scan the mass of the stop, you can scan the mass of the non-third generation squarks. But for each choice of these, you get a fixed ratio of branching, a fixed relationship among the branching ratios and the cross sections. So instead of being able to generate one kind of individual isolated Monte Carlo channels that you can mix at will, when you specify things in terms of specific masses, you're forcing the Susie relations on yourself, which means that in order to figure out what is the error on the cross section for BB, you're going to have to scan, take various different Susie models and scan the various parameters in order to get different branching ratios.
So not just the branching ratios, the kinematics as well.
And the kinematics is going to change too. So the masses, so this is the problem. When you're forcing Susie relationships, there's correlations between the cross sections, the branching ratios, and the mass scales. But the thing that you're what we believe that you're most sensitive to at the LHCs, we believe you're most sensitive to the cross sections and the branching ratios, not as sensitive to the masses. And the reason why we think you're very sensitive to branching ratios is that you really know if you have a little bit of an excess of leptons. And so when you say I'm going to jack up the TT branching ratio by a little bit, you're going to be dumping a lot more leptons into your signal, which you're going to know at the LHC. But if you want to do this in Susie, you have to, let's say, lower the stop mass. But this thing is getting correlated with a bunch of other things you're not measuring. That you're not measuring the stop mass to an accuracy of 5 GeV. But changing the stop mass by 5 GeV will give you a correlated change of the branching ratio of the order of, let's say, 5 to 10%, which you could see, assuming that you know what your lepton efficiencies are.
So you would assume that all three channels, let's say, were present.
All three channels are present?
Present, and you would allow, you know, and you would then be fitting the sigma and VR and so forth, and the relative amount of each channel.
That's correct.
Simultaneously.
That's correct. So the hard Monte Carlo thing is that you're going to have to generate 10,000 events of this decay, 10,000 events of this decay, 10,000 events of this decay. And unfortunately, because if you want to do things via phase space, you need to specify the masses in order to figure out where you live in phase space. So you pay a lot up front. You pay a huge amount up front to generate all these Monte Carlo files. but then you don't have to pay anything to measure the cross-section and branching ratio. And then someone could say, look, I'm going to measure different sets of observables. And then you don't have to do anything new. You just put those new sets of observables, use chi-squared or whatever way you want to fit things, and measure these things out.
Well, it sounds still a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
I mean, not only do you have to generate the events that you discussed, but you have to generate them, don't you, assuming relative branching ratios?
No, you say, I'm going to simulate just one thing. I'm going to have separate files. So file one is going to have, let's say we're doing Galeno pairs, like the first Galeno is going to go to BB chi naught, and the second Galeno is going to go to BB chi naught. That's file one, is this exclusive process. File two is going to have Galeno goes to BB chi naught, and the second Galeno goes to TT chi naught. Separate file. Then a third file that's going to have the same thing to TT chi naught, TT chi naught. So all the, and then, and because we know we have a very good understanding of how the top decays, you don't have to separately simulate the various ways the top can decay, we'll allow Pythia to decay the tops for us. But then the weighting of these three files turns into a measurement of the cross-section for Galeno pair production and the relative branching ratio of BB to TT. So you have to separately simulate all these three possibilities. So you don't, but you assume, basically in Pythia language, you say, I'm going to have the Galenos to have branching ratio 1 to BB in this model. This one, you say, I'm going to have Pythia branching ratio 1 to TT and TT. And it's challenging to get Pythia to decay one side always to BB and the other side always to TT, but Steve Marin has helped us figure out how to do that. It gets really complicated when you have many more different decay chains, but again, the idea here is that you simulate exclusive channels, so then you mix at the end of the day. And I'll show you how this works in practice.
So, if I change the masses around, how do I use these original Monte Carlos?
So if you change the masses around, you can't.
What if I change the neutralino mass?
If you change the neutralino mass, you
have to change the neutralino. You have to change the masses.
Yeah,
that is one of our dominant observables. So how do you do this?
Yes, you can. So, but this is.
So how is this an improvement?
Well, this is an improvement. No, no, this.
Every mass point.
No. This is an improvement just because you. I'll give two answers. The first one is that if you really believed it was Susan, let's say you're really convinced it was M. Sugra, then this is a waste of your time. Because M. Sugra has, what, four parameters in a sign, and it's easier to scan those four parameters than it is to do all this stuff. Even if you believe it's the MSSM, then it's borderline whether this is any better for you. Because with the MSSM, the number of free parameters, if you assume flavor universality, is getting to the point where it may not be worth doing this whole story. But if you think that there's anything funny going on, and you don't believe the relationship among Susy parameters, then you can get the one you don't solve the problem of how you individually scan for masses, but you do solve the problem of how you fit for cross section and branching ratios. So it solves part of your problem, but of course, phase space is going to you can't use the same Monte Carlo as you change phase space. What we have found is that you actually aren't that sensitive to masses for the kind of observables that we're using. That you can't really get that accurate.
This worries me. How do you know which observables you can use given this scheme?
Yeah,
which
so
observables should you definitely not use because the scheme has
right.
So out some degrees of freedom.
That's a valid question, something that we're researching. The expectation is that observables that aren't sensitive to matrix elements you're okay with. Observables that are sensitive to matrix elements
So
for example, never ever measure the invariant mass of two objects expecting to find an edge or an endpoint, because the structure of that edge or endpoint is very sensitive to where you are exactly in phase space and the matrix element. But if you measure the PT of two objects that are coming from some cascade decay, that's something that you expect not to be as messed up.
Why? Prove that.
I don't know if I can prove it. I mean,
you can't.
It
is dependent.
It depends upon mass scales.
But it's mostly dependent on mass scales. It's mostly dependent on where you are in phase space and less dependent on the matrix elements of those various places.
Right.
This is where my statement about 5 to 20% errors. Okay, 20% is already the extreme cases. But the goal is you run some program like this, and then you get a rough idea, and then you do the real thing. Then you actually put a real model. But this because of these facts, this saves you a huge amount of time in trying to figure out silly things like the Galeno branching ratios. In fact, if you don't believe anything I'm saying, just take the MSSM and just teach Pythia how to be an exclusive channels for you for the matrix elements you really like, and then do the exact same thing.
So I'm still confused how you're dealing with the mass scales. Are you doing
no,
this
you
for a whole different set of mass choices for, or not?
Yeah, no, so I'll show you some.
Putting any masses in, or?
No, I'm putting in masses in, so a model is specified by the particles and their masses and how they decay.
Okay, so
not
fit the events, you'll be fitting not only for the ratio of, say, these three possible channels,
yes,
but also for the mass scales that enter into each one of those.
Well, I wouldn't say that I would fit at the first instance. And the first thing I would try to guess the masses, and then given that set of masses, get fits. But in terms of getting error bars on the masses, that is still a very difficult problem that I don't know. So I'm saying you simulate one model, and someone says down the hall, oh no, I have a better model. I've tweaked the masses by 10 GeV in either direction. They simulate it, and in terms of whatever chi-square type variable you're using, their model fits better than you. But
of course, the cuts will make you pretty sensitive to these mass scales, I think.
You're vaguely sensitive to mass scales, but we're not sure exactly how sensitive you are to the mass scales. Maybe it's only because we're thinking in this exclusive tree language, but our experience is telling us we're actually more sensitive to branching ratios than we are to mass scales. But we are sensitive to mass scales on 100 GeV variation. But there's other techniques that you can use to try to guess what the mass scales are a little bit better, which I can show you a little bit later on. But no, you haven't solved that problem of changing mass scales.
So in order to claim that you're sensitive to branching ratios,
yeah,
you have to prove that I have seen a particle in two decay modes and that it's the same particle that I see in both decay modes. In particular, you have to measure its mass accurately enough to know that it is the same particle.
Here we're saying that you don't know that. I mean, how do you know if you have two
so
particles?
Then the branching ratio is the wrong quantity to be thinking, because what if it's two particles?
No, so it's good. And then what if it is two particles? How do you tell the difference between a single particle here that has 100% decay mode to one final state versus two particles? So, erase. We have this particle that decays 50% of the time in one way and 50% of the time in another way. Okay, but how do you tell the difference between two particles that are very nearly degenerate mass that decay 100% of the time one way and 100% of the time the other way?
Well,
these two possibilities.
Do you even know that you have a particle that's nearly degenerate mass?
Oh, okay. How do you tell? I have no idea how you tell that. I don't know techniques that one can use to try to tease out information like that at the LHC. But what the program would give you is it would say, let's say you put in one mass scale. If you put in one mass scale, it would say, okay, the branching ratios are 50%. Someone would then have to say, well, that could really be two particles. So then you could appeal to your theoretical biases in order to figure out whether it is two or one particle.
So the usual statement many people make is that at the LHC, you can't determine the overall mass scale very well.
Mm-hmm.
So if I scale the heavy mass,
mm-hmm,
the galeno mass,
yeah,
by some large amount, I'll scale the neutral inner mass.
That's
with
correct.
It. So in that case, mm-hmm, the branching rate, this argument of branching ratios would be completely wrong, because one of them is much, much heavier than the other.
What is much, much heavier than the other?
Say you have two particles, a galeno 1 and a galeno 2, just simple argument.
Yeah.
One is twice as heavy as the other one.
Yes.
All the intermediate particles in the chain are also twice as heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so characterizing that as a branching ratio would be
characterizing it for this
right.
given choice of masses, I think
yes.
these are the branching ratios. For a different choice of masses, here's what I think the branching ratios are. Yeah, you are right in being worried that there's a flat direction as you scan things around. One would hope that you have other kinematic observables that you can use in order to fix the overall size, but you are going to have a flat direction generically. If you can only measure mass differences, you can take the cross-section for some process and, have the cross-section be the same for some process and just take the galeno mass and neutral galeno mass and take two different scenarios. That these things may in fact look exactly the same. You'd hope that there'd be some information in the missing energy distribution to tell them apart, but if you fix the same cross-sections for these two processes, the final states are going to be the same. Yeah, that's a problem. The only hope that you would have is that then with theoretical bias, you would say, aha, if I really believe that this is a color octet that I'm creating, then there's a correlation between the mass and the cross-section that I'm measuring. And so then you might say theoretical bias would prefer one scenario over another. But if you cannot tell the difference, then I think you would try to just assign, you would try to measure or account for this flat direction in sigma mass of galeno space and just characterize it and give a number. Because, unfortunately, this technique is one that it costs you a lot Monte Carlo-wise to change the masses, then you're in trouble. But at least it doesn't cost you anything to change the branching ratios. So you're saving yourself a little bit. But yeah, no, it's a perfectly valid concern.
So then I guess this gets to my previous question. Mm-hmm. That is, in order to deal with this scenario, you really need to be able to say, this is a set of observables I should not look at because it is sensitive to this.
It is sensitive to observables,
which is sensitive to this.
To this mass split?
Yes.
Yes, and then I would say, by all means, use it.
Well, yeah, but you have to know which observables those are.
Yeah, I would say use every observable. I mean, if you use as many observables as you can put in, try not to overcount, but try to put as many observables as you can possibly imagine putting in, and use those as your measurements, and hope that at the 5 to 20% error that they don't depend on matrix elements, which is something you have to check. But
just the mass scale.
Yeah, so I would love to put in observables that are sensitive to the overall mass scale. Yes, put them in.
This
would come up with a pi squared of 10, and this would come up with a pi squared of 100.
But by the time you put in all four vectors,
mm-hmm.
you do have sensitivity to the mass scale. It's in there somewhere.
Sure. No, I'm not saying that the techniques that you're developing are not. I'm thinking about a different problem. I'm thinking about the problem of what if you have many, many different final states. How do you figure out the relative amount of different final states, as opposed to what you're more concerned about is how do you figure out the relative mass scales?
Maybe we should carry this on later.
Yeah.
I'll let you continue.
Yeah. Okay. So. The other reason that you should be worried about simulating, what we're arguing by not using matrix elements is that we're arguing that you can get yourself into trouble if you simulate using, let's say, SUSY matrix elements at low luminosity. That have you actually measured the spin yet? You can ask, have you measured the spin yet? Do you have an effective straw man to compare a SUSY with some other non-SUSY scenario? And in principle, with this technique, you don't have to answer that question right away. Do you know whether your squarks are on or off shell? If you have a gluino that decays to a bottom neutralino, have you actually measured whether the spottom is on or off shell? They're going to give you the same final states if the spottom is on or off shell. Have you actually measured that? If you approximate this by a blob, then you can avoid having to answer that question whether it's on or off shell, and maybe when you get more information, you'll be able to resolve, oh, wait, it really was on shell, I should rather put in this intermediate particle. So the goal is to, with as little information as you can, come up with some Monte Carlo that you can compare it to experiment that kind of factorizes the problem of theorists can very easily, in their mind, interpolate between spottom on shell and off shell, but a computer takes a lot of Monte Carlo time to interpolate the mass of this spottom. It's much easier to just characterize it as a phase space decay. Okay.
In fact, the phase space is rather different for those two different configurations.
Yeah, so the phase space is different if you know how to identify the bottoms,
mm-hmm.
but if you just are looking for, if you have an event that has four bottoms and you're worried about combinatoric background and you haven't identified these things correctly, then it's more of the rate of how many times did I get two versus four versus zero bottoms. That is what you're more sensitive to than you would be to the actual kinematic structure of this.
So, just for a data point here,
we're
finding that with order 10 events, I can tell you whether that's a two-body decay or three-body decay.
Yeah. So if that works, then what I'm talking about here is a complete waste of time. I should be dropping this whole story. But the way that we were coming at it was that events with huge high multiplicity or combinatoric background is very difficult. Where you have events where you imagine that your benchmark is four tops. Four tops is, you know, four Bs, four Ws. Those Ws have decays to leptons, to jets. Okay, how are you going to figure out that you have tops in an environment like that? That's our starting assumptions. Why do we think that matrix elements are not important? The reason why we think matrix elements are not important are the following. In the case of telling an on-shell versus an off-shell decay, you may be able to tell if you have enough luminosity or if you've been able to kind of study this very carefully. But if you only, and you certainly would be sensitive to the difference between on-shell and off-shell decays if you measure the invariant masses of particles. But if you only measure the PTs of objects, then you're going to be less sensitive to this distinction. And so you can still get reasonable information even if you forgot an on-shell channel, assuming that there's no giant hierarchy of mass scales. So that's our hypothesis that we've found is true, and there's some examples, but we haven't completely proven. Also, in this framework, it's very easy to put in an on-shell particle later if you really believe that there is on-shell. The other thing that you might worry about matrix elements leaving them out is, you know, there's a difference between, let's say, gluino pair production by an S-channel gluon and gluino pair production by a T-channel gluino. But one thing that we've realized is that, you know, what's different about these things? These things are different in their matrix elements squared. Well, let's take these matrix elements squared, let's expand it in a power series. We can expand it always in a power series, and some function of S plus another function of S times Z plus another function of S times Z squared, where Z is cosine theta with respect to the beam axis. And in terms of the matrix elements, you know, you're dominated by this term, because stuff that's going at high Z, that high cosine theta down the beam pipe, you're going to be less likely to pick that up at the LHC.
No, I mean, so the gluino itself can be collinear with the beam line.
That's right.
The decay products will be
good, but once it's good, excellent. But once it's decayed, now you're isotropic again. So once those things have decayed, you've gone back to being isotropic. So then you're really dominated by this again. So that's an excellent point. So this thing is capturing the isotropic nature of your decay element. So I'm claiming that you're going to be dominated by this term. And also, this term itself is dominated by threshold. Because everything is falling functions of S, you're dominated by just barely being able to create those gluons. So assuming that you have this matrix element approximated by a flat distribution, you're going to be not that wrong, because the PDFs give you a natural shaping of your matrix elements. And again, you're dominated by this term, you're dominated by the isotropic, and then this term itself is dominated by threshold. You can't read this, but isotropic on threshold, that's what we claim here, that at the 5 to 20% level, you're being dominated by the matrix element.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't understand your argument with respect to my question. So
yeah.
if the gluon goes down the beam line,
yes,
and decays isotropically,
yes,
that means that the initial this matrix element,
mm-hmm,
has contributions from the second two terms.
That's correct.
Important.
Yes.
So how are you?
So what I'm saying is that if you have two gluons that are going this way,
yeah,
that the decays of these, the decay products of this, once, if this is a two-body decay, then the decays in the gluino rest frame are isotropic.
Yes.
And the decays in this frame are isotropic. So whatever correlation you might have had with the beam axis has now been blurred out for you, because now the decays have been isotropic. So the extent to which you're not sensitive to spin correlations, it's as if you had an effective matrix element that was isotropic.
In terms of the overall rate.
In terms of the overall rate. I mean, because you're scaling out rate. Of course, these things affect what the overall rate is going to be, but in terms of the kinematic structure, you're not going to be, we claim that you're not going to be sensitive to it. So let me give you some of this data that I'm claiming for why we think this is a good idea. And this is, okay, not only is it preliminary, but it's also not the most recent that we have. Let's see how I get this.
To turn it on button there.
It turned itself off.
Oh, turn itself off.
You have to press several times.
That's too bad. But let me just give you some of the evidence that we have for this. Also, I should mention that in terms of this matrix element, this is systematically improvable. That if you really believe that this subdominant term is important, you can put it in. You can put in two processes, this cross section and this one, and then you can even weight them if you really believe that you're sensitive to both of them. You can weight them in the fit, and then the relative cross-section of this versus this, you might be able to pick up some of that information. We don't think that you can do it, but at least on the examples that we've looked at, you've been able to tell sensitivity to the matrix element at the level that you might want. But let me... So just some reality checks. These were kind of the first plots that we made for ourselves to convince ourselves that this wasn't a horrible idea. So, oops. Okay. So this is gluino pair production, where the gluinos decay by spottoms, off-shell spottoms, and then to a neutralino. So we have 4B jets, and all we're doing is we're summing the PTs of all the jets. Black is real Monte Carlo using real matrix elements in Pythia, and red is what we use for our mocked-up, with our on-shell effective description, with using flat matrix elements. And for flat matrix elements, in terms of this variable sum PT, you end up getting the shape better than you have any right to get it. So this is with a flat matrix element, you find, wow, I really can fit in a pair production using of course, here we put in the mass scale by hand, so we're getting the mass scale right. And then these are just some examples of what happens if you change the matrix element. If you use a matrix element for glue goes to fermion via T-channel fermion, you see you also kind of match the jet overall shape. And if you use the wrong PDFs and the wrong matrix element, you see, yeah, you get a little bit of kind of 5 to 10%-ish errors in terms of the red versus the real Monte Carlo, the real matrix element black. But roughly speaking, you're getting the peak right, too. That in terms of the matrix elements in this kind of variable, it seems like you're sensitive mostly to the mass scale. And then your choice of matrix element, PDF, maybe PDF is a little bit important, but you're not as sensitive to those things for this particular variable. So you can imagine fitting to this variable, and you wouldn't mess things up. You would be ignorant about what you are ignorant about, namely what the matrix element is, and we're hoping that you'll be sensitive to the branching ratio. To give you a sense of how this might work, to give you a sense of when this is bad, this is gluino-neutralino associated production. And again, we put in the mass scales correct, but if you use a flat matrix element for this sum PT, you find, yeah, you're a little bit off. The peak's in the right place, but the overall normalization is off. Again, this is what we're talking about. This is probably more on the 20% error side. If we improve it slightly by going to a more appropriate matrix element, it gets a better fit. But it's clear why gluino-neutralino associated production, why you're getting things wrong. You're getting things wrong because you're exploring a lot more of the of S space, of your invariant mass distribution space. The neutralino can be highly boosted or not very boosted, and so you're not dominated by threshold anymore, and this is the reason why you're getting these differences. So if we have a catalog of the places where you get it right and where you get it wrong, you would hope to be able to use this method in a systematic way. To give you a sense of how this would really work, imagine taking gluino pairs, and we're setting what the stop and spottom masses are. The star next to the spottom means that, for whatever reason, we think that number's wrong. We think it's around 2 TeV. We have 860 GeV. Gluino's decaying down to a nearly degenerate neutralino chargino set. And so these are the channels that are open to you. The gluino can go down to a TT bar in this neutral guy, TB and the neutral guy plus soft guys, BB and the neutral guy. And then we put in, this wasn't in the model, but we put in first generation quarks as part of the possible decays to see whether the program would tell you, oh no, there really is none of that. And this is unfortunately about 2 weeks old numbers, but here are some of the PT distributions, and we see that as we're weighting these various different channels, we can get the various distributions to line up fairly well, again, 5 to 20% errors. And then we tried scanning the gluino mass, and our chi-squared variable didn't really change all that much. It happened to be the best chi-squared, happened to be at 850, which is around the mass of the gluino. We don't know how much to trust that. And then for the various branching ratios to BB, JetJet, TB, and TT, we see that, oh, it's supposed to be 15%, came out 11. It's supposed to be 0, and it came out 0. It's supposed to be 75%, it came out, supposed to be 68, came out 75. It's supposed to be 17, came out 14. So we're getting things roughly to the 5 to 20% error. We don't know, again, there's no error bars on this information quite yet, but it gives you a sense of how we think you'd run this. So you make a guess for the model, guess for what the mass scales and the allowed open channels are, and then you fit for the cross-section and the branching ratio.
How would you define the error bars?
So the way we're playing with a couple of different ways of defining the error bars. And we're trying to figure out what actually is a rigorous way to define error bars, but something that seems to work kind of well in practice, though we haven't been able to justify it, is if you have some model that has some chi-squared value, so this is the best fit chi-squared, kind of a reasonable error bar is taking the chi-squared plus the square root of that best chi-squared. If you define the surface enclosed by this value of chi-squared, it seems to be roughly right. We have no way this is kind of what you expect. Pi squared is roughly a sum of sigma squareds, and if you take sigma to sigma plus 1, this gives you the scaling of pi squared goes to pi squared plus root pi squared. So that's the motivation for using this kind of metric, but we haven't justified it. We don't know how it scales with the number of degrees of freedom, so on and so forth. So we're trying to figure out how you're supposed to do this, how you're supposed to define errors for these parameters, but in principle we should be able to get it. We played a little game this past week. We made up little boxes for ourselves, and one person made up the box, the other person tried to guess what the best on-shell description was. And so this was motivated by the third LHC Olympics, and we took the black box that Scott Thomas of Rutgers made for this LHC Olympics, and we tweaked it a little bit to make it easier. And what his scenario was an R parity violating Susie scenario, and it was R parity violating such that the decay at the very end always gave you leptons. So this is a huge number of leptons. Every event has 4 leptons in it, well above standard model background. And the dominant signature was, geez, we have a lot of bjets and leptons. And in a lepton-rich environment with a lot of bjets, you say, do I have tops? Can we figure out whether there are tops or not? And we also are thinking down the road of, can you tell whether there was lepton flavor violation? You should be able to if you have some sense of e-ness versus mu-ness. How sensitive are we really to the mass scales? We knew what the mass scales were playing this game, so it was a bit of a cheat. And also, if you're getting big processes wrong to the 5 to 20% level, what about rare processes? Do you swamp out those rare processes because you've made errors on the initial kind of dominant matrix element? So what we did was, okay, here's how you enter particles. You take the particles, you say what their electromagnetic color charges and masses are. You say how you want to produce them. You say how they're going to decay. Very easy input, and then automatically generates tons of Monte Carlo for you. And this gibberish over here stands for pair production of galenos and stops. The galenos allows you to decay via top. The stop can go via a B or a top down to neutralino or B down to the chargino. And the chargino decay gives you either a lepton, neutrino, or a W. This would be via an intermediate lepton. And the neutralino always decays to LL nu with flavor violation. So we said, okay, here's our model. Let's try to fit it to the data. Let's try to fit the cross sections and branching ratios to see how it compares to the data. And this is hard to read, but you see, okay, here are pull information. It's telling you that you're missing stuff. You're being pulled down. It says our best thing says there's 0.3 events. We're trying to get 10. But it's instructive to see what channels you're missing. You're missing low multiplicity channels. So these two lines here are 3 plus leptons, but 0 or 2, 0, 1 or 2 jets. So we're missing this channel. It suggests that we forgot to put in direct production. We forgot to put in low multiplicity channels. So you put in direct production of the neutralinos and charginos without. So seeing this, okay, we can get some more diagnostic information. We see. Here's our attempted error bars, but they came out horribly wrong. But it says, okay, we think that there's 35% of the time you're making galenos, 65% of the time you're making stops, and then in terms of the stop decays, the real answer is 75% and 25%, and it's getting it right, but again, there's no error bars, so we don't know how lucky that was. And the total chi-squared for this fit was large, 600, the number of degrees of freedom is around 60, so chi-squared of 10 per degree of freedom is rather large. And you can kind of see exactly where you messed up. Here's a bunch of different plots of the PTs of objects. Again, we're doing PTs because we think they're less sensitive to matrix elements. And we see, yes, at low sum PT, this happens to be a region that would be swamped by standard model background, but ignoring background, we're missing events at low PT. So we can just put them back in. That is, we can take our existing model, add some more gibberish over here to allow for a neutralino production, pair production of charginos, associated production of chargino neutralino, and specify how we think the neutralino decays via intermediate leptons. And again, we can run the fit information. Now the fit's much better. There are no 5 sigma channels, given the kind of observables that we're using. We can get the best fit numbers. Amusingly, for reasons that we don't quite understand, there is a large flat direction such that the best fit for the stop branching ratio, it's supposed to be 75. We got it 75 in the previous fit. Now it's down to 60%. So there's some interesting correlation going on that we don't quite understand. But the chi-squared went down by a factor of 10. That's Chi squared of degree of freedom about 1. We're getting rough information, and hopefully in a week's time we'll be able to get correct error bar information. And you can just check. You can say, wow, isn't this amazing? In the sum t distribution, we see the shoulder. Why do we have the shoulder? We have the shoulder because there is pair production of stops, pair production of boolinos, and this program has mixed them appropriately to generate the correct distribution. All the other distributions are, you know, good to the 5 to 10, 20% level.
So you're mixing several channels here?
Yeah, so there's 17 channels in terms of all the very possible decays, and you just mix those 17 channels and then reinterpret that as a cross-section and branching ratio calculation, and it looks pretty good. Now, of course, we cheated. We put in the masses. We knew what the masses were. Here, these numbers are, you know, within 10 GeV of the right answer. And what one would hope is one would hope by studying distributions like the sum PT or the PT of B-jets or jets that you'd be able to get some handle on what the overall mass scales were, because as you change those mass scales, these things are going to shift around a lot. And so we're actively now trying to really be blind, to really do a blind study where we don't know anything about the model. Can we build it up iteratively? And then once you get this rough sense, once you get this table of best fit cross-sections and branching ratios, then you go and say, okay, do I even believe this? Can I make a SUSY model that's roughly consistent with that? Then simulate with real matrix elements and go from there. Okay, so that's what I wanted to show you in terms of our preliminary kind of computer simulation. And in the last 2 minutes, let me just tell you why I'm excited about this technique. I'm excited about this technique because it's the first systematic way that I've seen for dealing with high multiplicity events. If you really think that there is going to be a lot of tops produced, not just, obviously we know there's going to be a lot of top pair events, but if you think there's going to be a lot of top events produced in SUSY or Little Higgs type theories, if you really think there's a natural solution to the hierarchy problem, you probably expect to see top rich events. How do you tell the presence of tops if you can't actually reconstruct the top? And this is some way of trying to, at least in the best fit sense, tell whether you have tops or not. I like this technique because it postpones the debate about whether you've seen, let's say, a universal extra dimensions type model or a SUSY type model, because the matrix elements, because you're not putting in matrix elements, you're not sensitive to questions of spin. And because we're not measuring spin information, in principle, you can get branching ratio information without having to know what kind of underlying spin structure you're dealing with. I like this technique because it seems to factorize the question of how you go from LHC models or tarot-scale Lagrangians to LHC models, that Marmoset seems to be possibly an intermediate step where LHC data can be matched onto Marmoset models, and then once you get some rough information, you can go back and try to do things honestly. And also, it's trivial to go from a Lagrangian to Marmoset description for the cross-section branching ratios, and it's trivial to do the Monte Carlo step of Marmoset to LHC. So it seems to kind of factorize a difficult problem into two slightly easier problems. And it helps you deal with ambiguous LHC data. If you don't know that you have SUSY, instead of saying, we see an excess consistent with the SUSY model, you could say, we have an excess consistent with these rough mass scales and these rough cross-sections and branching ratios. There's a lot of physics questions to be answered. How well does this really work in practice? Is this going to be a tool that's useful? A couple experimental challenges for using this is that this program requires correlated excesses. You can't, because you're only measuring PTs, you can't do exactly what you're talking about, trying to reconstruct the whole event. You're really relying on, in order to get this branching ratio information, looking at correlated excesses in many different channels. How hard is that to do when you have trigger bias and such? This program is, in some sense, an after-the-champagne tool. You use it when you see a large number of excesses. Is there any way of retrofitting this program to allow you to deal with small excesses and trying to figure out what they really are? And the other thing that I find interesting is that this is a human-operated tool. You put a guess in for what your on-shell effective description is. And because it's a human-operated tool, how are we going to actually be able to use this in an experiment? Is a theorist going to use this tool and hand it to an experimentalist, or experimentalist going to use this tool? But what I'm encouraged by is I'm encouraged by these kind of preliminary results that tell you with little amounts of information, you can get some sense of the structure with low luminosity. So this is the direction that I'm interested in pursuing and interested to hear your comments. So I'm going to end now.
I'm very worried about the procedure of scanning over mass space for high multiplicity events.
Yeah.
I think I counted 12 masses in your original diagram.
Yeah.
Right? So that means that I have to, I think, scale like n to the 12th.
Yep.
Number of points I wanted for the 12th.
Yep.
That's intractable. Absolutely intractable.
Well, so the question is whether if you use these observables, if you're only sensitive to the 50 GeV level and you have some theoretical bias put in, it's still better than having to do the same thing in SUSE. It's still better than having to do the traditional way of thinking about Monte Carloing when you have to specify models.
Absolutely.
So the
hard problem is the end of the 12th.
Yeah. It is hard.
So you're changing the coefficient in front of the end of the 12th.
Yeah. I don't think it's changing the coefficient. I think you can reuse.
Well, if I had a different technique, any technique you want, you still have to scan the 12th, right? So it's the end of the 12th we have to deal with for high multiplicity.
I'm not so worried about the end of the 12th when I think that there's other ways of getting the mass scales. So, for example, I don't think that I need to really scan a mass parameter over a huge range. If I have some bias, then if I measure the sum PT distribution, roughly speaking, the peak of this thing is going to be at twice the mass of the mother particle, roughly speaking. And so I can use this information.
Well, this is assuming there's not. I mean, you can for this observable, you can scale it by the overall mass scale.
Yeah, and what I would do is I would want to get. The goal is to get kind of one model that roughly fits, and then iterate from there. You're trying just to get something that roughly matches the data that uses all the available LAC data. That's kind of the goal. The goal is not to use this as an actual measurement tool. The goal of error bars is not so that experimentalists can write a PRL paper saying this is the honest to goodness error bars. How can you believe that if you don't know what the errors on not using the right matrix element are? The goals of having it displayed that way is that it gives you some sense of the range over which models that you would conceivably try to simulate honestly would likely fall in. That's kind of the philosophy we're coming in. We don't want to scan over this as you're saying, into the 12th space. No one wants to scan over it. The goal is to kind of iteratively build up stuff. Let me give you another way of saying this. What you're worried about is let's say you have the dominant channel is Galeno goes to Neutralino, Galeno goes to Neutralino. Let's say you can isolate this channel. Then if you take the stops to be off-shell, then there's just two mass scales. And you can go back and then put the stops in on-shell, and then you can have more information. But if this is what you think is dominating, you start off with two mass scales, which is much easier to simulate. Then you can iteratively go back and say, okay, now I'm going to fix these mass scales, and now I'm going to start adding more information. So I'm not imagining scanning the whole spectrum. I had a couple other decays in here, too. I'd say, okay, let's hope that maybe we're lucky. Maybe this secondary decay is less important, so I don't have to scan all three of these mass scales. Let's try to find, you don't know which way to go. Do you try to find the simplest decay structure or the more complicated decay structure?
So what you're saying there is you want to integrate out, essentially, on-shell or off-shell top decay and remove that as an observable.
For the initial running. Yeah, for the initial running of the program. If you have evidence for on-shell and off-shell, for example, if you measure the PT of the hardest B-jet, and you measure the PT of the second hardest B-jet, if you see that they're roughly equal, then you say, I have no way of telling that it's on-shell or off-shell. But if you see that the second hardest B-jet is much, much softer than the first hardest B-jet, then you might have some evidence that you actually have some on-shell things, that some phase space is telling you that there's a generic difference between on-shell and off-shell. So only if you saw this would I go in and say, okay, I'm going to have the extra computational cost of having to scan over that mass parameter, I'd start off with the simpler thing and then kind of zoom in as I thought necessary. But especially these observables that I'm fitting to here are inclusive counts of just how many B-jets are there,
yep.
Not even what their PTs are.
I worry that an experimentalist will take what you've done and say, okay, I'm looking at exclusive observables.
Yeah.
Now I want to be a little more clever.
Yeah.
I'm going to take some other observable and put it in there.
Yeah.
But just because, they might find accidentally that this observable doesn't factorize. It actually does have information
And then they would, everything would just go all screwy.
And yeah, sure. And that's why it requires.
So you have to kind of enumerate which observables you want to look at.
Sure, and that's an active thing that we're trying to do. But you know, another way of saying this whole question is you know, there's people who say we'd love to do bottom up studies. We'd love to take LHC data, and we'd love to start from the bottom up and just include the minimum amount of information that you need to reproduce the data. This is easy to do if you see resonances. If you see resonances, great. But how do you do a bottom-up if you have these high multiplicity events? And the goal of this is to kind of have this first step, okay, bottom-up, great, I'm going to use this silly tool that may or may not work to try to just accomplish that first bottom-up step in order to then kind of bounce to a more top-down view of what the actual underlying model was. And the more top-down view, I think, is one that is more relevant later on. But I'd be interested to hear more about your technique to see whether you can really get things earlier in the game with low luminosity.
I would argue that if you really have low luminosity and few number of events, you need fancier tools, right, to dig up the small signal.
Sure. I mean, how do you correlate 10 2-sigma excesses to say you have a 5-sigma discovery?
Yeah.
Certainly. Yeah.
One last question, real quick. Do you have a sense for how often in models you get high multiplicity appearing first over low multiplicity stuff?
It depends on. So if you take Suzy as the example, no one's going to trust the 4-jet inclusive with missing energy distribution. And so already, in order to get someone to be excited about a signal in the early stages, you really need leptons in there. And already, once you say you need leptons, then you're already talking about fairly high multiplicity. If you believe it's colored particle production, instantly you have 2 jets. If you want to tag on a lepton or 2 leptons, already you're talking about 2 jets, 2 leptons, and then it can only go up from there. So, you know, high multiplicity is relative, but if you really aren't making resonances, we expect, including a pair production, you start off with 4 jets. You know, we're expecting you to have rough, you know, high multiplicity events. Plus, high multiplicity events may be the first thing that you're convinced is above background. If you haven't done the NLO calculation for whatever standard model background, if you see a 4-lepton event, you're going to study that one to death because you know it's new physics. So that's also the kind of motivation for thinking about high multiplicity events. But obviously, you know, the cross-section for direct production of stuff that is 100 GeV, it's huge at the LHC, it's just swamped by background.
So what is your plan when you plan to make this program public, available for everybody? Can John use this
sure.
to test his fixedness model?
Or
he has to do some programming?
No. The goal would be to make this there's 2 questions. One, can you use this software? Sure, I can give it to you right now, and you can play with it. Is this software going to be useful for matching LHC accesses? Only if they give you access to the data. So this is a tool that someone's going to have to operate, but it has to be operated with data. And we'd have to figure out how to pipe this to a fast enough version of a detector simulation at a real Atlas or CMS in order to make it useful. Because, again, you're relying on Monte Carlo. You're not relying on measurement, and that's a difficult thing. You have to know. Yeah, I don't know to what extent you can use a fast detector simulation and get the right answer. But sure, I can give you this offer right now, and you can. It's fun. You get to make whatever decay chains you want. You get to see how things grow. You know, when you have many, many different ratios, and you can then fit it, and it will spit out numbers for you. You can say, "Geez, I don't like your minimization algorithm. I'm worried about these things." You can kind of play around with that. So yes, but I think ultimately this is a tool that an experimentalist would have to use to be useful. Unless they want to give me access to the data, which I'd be happy to take.
Most of the question is, well, let's say this Higgs model has certain states in this model. Do we need to put that? Well, how much program do we need to do after we get your program? Do we need to put in those states, or it's a
sorry? So what you
for example, it's not Suzy or
yeah. So what is the model that you want to have? You want to all you have to specify. You write a little text thing. It's like inputting new particles in MathGraph, only easier. You say, I have particle 1. So literally what you do, you have 1 file. You give me 1 file, I give you everything. I give you the answer. So the file is, I have particle 1. Its mass is 300 GeV. Its charge is plus 1. It's color neutral. I have particle 2. Let's make it charge 0 so I don't get confused. Particle 2, its mass is 150. It's also charge neutral and color neutral. I think that I'm pair producing with the gluon PDFs. I'm pair producing. Okay, you can't do that. I'm using the UU bar PDFs, and I'm pair producing particle 1 and particle 1. And I think that particle 1 decays to particle 2 in the Z. This is what you give the program. You write this down, and then you go hit enter, and it gives you the branching. Well, in this case, it's stupid. It's going to give you 100% branching ratio for this, 100% branching ratio for that. Or 100% cross-section for this, because you haven't given it any other information. But if you gave them a third particle, then you could say P1 goes to P3Z, it would give you the best fit, tell you what all the problems were, spit out 1,000 pages of PDF plots for you to stare at and say, where did you mess up? It's very easy input because there's no matrix element. There's nothing to put in. Everything's by phase space. Yeah, so the input is simple. The interpretation is the hard thing.